was an IRIB English radio program.
This hour's top stories. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says the truce between Israel and Hamas is a historic victory for the Palestinians. Palestinians pour into the streets of the besieged Gaza Strip, celebrating what they call, quote-unquote, the victory of the resistance over the Israeli occupation. And Iran says the continuation of U.S.'s sanctions as leverage against Tehran in the ongoing nuclear talks is unacceptable. Welcome to the program. Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says the recent truce between the Israeli regime and Hamas amounted to a triumph for the Palestinian resistance groups. In a statement, Hezbollah congratulated Palestinian people and resistance groups on their victory. It said the development has unmasked the weaknesses of and chasms within the Tel Aviv regime. The Lebanese movement added the ceasefire also indicates that the full liberation of Palestinian territories can be achieved in the near future. In the statement, Hezbollah said, the resistance front once again breathed new life into the cause of Palestine and invoked hope among the oppressed across the world. The movement also said the war between Hamas and Israel proved that the resistance front has the upper hand against the enemy on the path to freedom and victory. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned Israel against any further acts of aggression following a ceasefire that took effect early on Friday, May the 21st.
It is true that the battle ends today, but Netanyahu and the whole world should know that our hands are on the trigger and we will continue to ramp up the capabilities of this resistance. And we are telling Netanyahu and his army, if you come back, we will come back too.
The Hamas officials said the Israeli regime must end its acts of violence in Jerusalem al-Quds and address the damage from its bombardment of the Gaza Strip. It said Tel Aviv must also end the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in East Jerusalem al-Quds, which he described as a red line. Al-Rashir added Al-Aqsa Mosque must also be protected. His comments came after a truce went into force early Friday following 11 days of relentless Israeli airstrikes and artillery attacks on the besieged territory. Jubilant Palestinians have taken to the streets of the Gaza Strip to celebrate a truce between the resistance movement, Hamas and Israel.
This is a joyful moment for all Gaza. This is the victory for Ramadan, the Eid, and Jerusalem. We will return all the occupied lands, all the cities. If they call us, we will be the first to be with them.
We were watching the media outlets. The victory of the resistance is the victory for all the Muslims. The Palestinian resistance returned the dignity for all Muslims.
The ceasefire ended 11 days of air raids and shelling by the Israeli regime and retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance groups. The conflict between the two sides has been the most intense in 7 years. The truce was brokered and is being monitored now by Egypt. Israeli attacks on Gaza killed 232 Palestinians, including 65 children. More than 1,900 people were also injured in the onslaught. Moreover, 12 Israelis were also killed and hundreds injured in Hamas's retaliatory strikes on Israeli cities. To discuss the latest situation, we're going to be joined by Mona Kandil, our correspondent, who joins us via Skype out of Ramallah, out of the same city. I will also host Professor Saad Nimri. He is a professor of political science with Berzeit University. It's good to have you with us both on the show. To help us with a better understanding, I'm just going to hand you over to Mona Kandil first. She's our correspondent there, to tell us about the mood in that part of the world in light of this recent ceasefire.
Well, immediately following the announcement of a ceasefire here in the occupied territories, and the statements that came from the Israelis themselves that they agreed to halt their firing rockets towards the besieged Gaza Strip, thousands of Palestinians across the occupied West Bank, and after 2 a.m. when the ceasefire came into effect, thousands of Palestinians poured onto the streets of Ramallah, of Jenin, of Bethlehem, all across the occupied West Bank, in order to celebrate what they described as a historic victory for the Palestinians. For them, the Israeli regime announcing a ceasefire, this means that the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, not only speaking about the resistance groups there, but all Palestinians have really achieved a victory. Of course, the Israeli media and the Israeli military, specifically the spokesman of the Israeli military, said that over 40 rockets had been fired from the Gaza Strip before the ceasefire. However, they say that the unarmed aerial vehicles in the sky over the Gaza Strip are ready to attack should rockets be fired. So they are saying that they are ready for any firing of the rockets. It's a ceasefire to allow maybe more mediation and more talks with the mediating countries in order to stop completely this Israeli aggressive and airstrikes that has been fired against the besieged enclave.
All right. Professor Nimre in Ramallah, please share with us your understanding of the recent developments that led to this ceasefire.
As Mona just said, Palestinians are in euphoria. Palestinians are so happy today, and they declare this victory. And it is victory all over, not only the ceasefire, but also for the international community, for unifying the Arabs, for having the Palestinian put forward their demands, especially in Jerusalem and the Sheikh Jarrah. For all these reasons, the Palestinian would celebrate today and consider it as a huge victory. And as we say, the blood was victor over the sword. The Palestinian had put forward too many sacrifices, as the reports is telling about the casualties, whether in Gaza or even in the West Bank during this intifada. But at the same time, these sacrifices are absolutely accepted in the outcome of changing the a lot of things. But mainly, I believe that this round had changed a lot of our understanding to the whole struggle. For instance, now we have unifying Palestinians from inside Israel, from inside the occupied territories 48, and the Palestinians in West Bank and Jerusalem, as well as in Gaza. In addition to that, refugees in Lebanon and in Jordan, the two major countries where we have refugees, they were also sharing the Palestinian. This round unified all Palestinians all over, which means that this is the final nail in the coffin of Oslo agreement. And now we think that we are coming to a new kind of an era, a new kind of thinking, and perhaps also lots of changes. Mainly that the Palestinians now do believe in the resistance, and now they are not talking about solving the problem by negotiations and two-state solution, but rather talking about all of Palestine, and this to defeat this colonial project, this colonial Zionist racist apartheid regime once and for all.
Mona, to what extent do you see that as a fact on the ground, what the professor just mentioned? And of course, you know, what has happened within the past 11 days, you know, in raising the spirit of the Palestinians in order to perhaps, you know, remain hopeful and even more hopeful than the past, that, you know, total freedom of their lands, you know, is a possibility and is getting nearer than what they already thought.
Well, yes, on Tuesday specifically, with thousands of Palestinians taking to the streets in every city, in Ramallah, in Nablus, in Jenin, Beit Lahem, Ariha, also known as Jericho, in historic Palestine, the lands that were occupied in 1948, and in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, all Palestinians from all walks of life representing the different political factions, Islamic and national powers in the occupied territories, all of them had been taking part in demonstrations to support the Gaza Strip, to support the resistance, to say no for the illegal Israeli practices and the deadly airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. For the first time since long years, Palestinians have been united on the streets, holding the Palestinian family, saying the Palestinian flags, of course, saying that they are all one Palestinian family. What happens in the Gaza Strip would definitely affect the people in Jerusalem and in the occupied West Bank and in historic Palestine. That national general strike had united the Palestinians, saying that Gaza Strip and the resistance groups have came to defend Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Al-Quds. So for the first time, Palestinians really feel they are united on the ground. It's not Fatah, Hamas, the Jihad movement, other political powers. They are all Palestinians united together to defend Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and to defend every Palestinian area.
Mm-hmm. Professor Nemr, what do you think? You know, because obviously Gaza, the Hamas movement, and of course, you know, Palestinian factions, look at this development, a resistance that finally led to some kind of victory because a ceasefire had to be signed, although Israel being the much stronger power here. I wonder if the Israelis look at it as a victory. And how will this play out within the Israeli politics and, you know, the costs it's going to have specifically for Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Okay, before Netanyahu, let me say first of all that all newspapers today and the media in Israel this morning, they were absolutely commenting, all of them commenting on and making statements regarding what happened last night. All of them, they say this is the victory of Hamas, this is the victory of the Palestinians over the Israelis. And they criticize Netanyahu that he pulled Israel into this confrontation intentionally to keep his position. So today, lots of articles were trying to discuss the situation, and they all agreed that they see it as a victory for the Palestinians. The thing that is also importantly interested, that lots of Israelis saying that we are not going to continue to live in Israel. We need to go out and to live somewhere else. This country became dangerous for us, and we would witness in the coming few weeks lots of Israelis who are going to evacuate their areas or to leave Israel. Already the incoming immigrants to Israel are far less than those who are leaving Israel. This huge myth about Israel being a safe haven for all Jews around the world is absolutely proven by this round, this time, 2021, that it is absolutely divided and no one believe anymore that Israel is a safe place for Jews. And that's because of that, lots of them are intending now to leave and to emigrate outside of the country. All that gives you the feeling about what extent really this victory was huge. The Palestinian resistance over 3 wars before 2008, 2012, and 2014, they are developing their methods, they are developing their tactics, and that proven. This time it was very much not only organized, but very accurate and very under control. And the Palestinians organized and, if you like, orchestrated this kind of war their own way. They give dates, they give times, and they committed to that. The Israeli tried to bombard Gaza. They were claiming that they are targeting the rocket bases and they are targeting leaders, but everyone knows, including in Israel, that was also fake and nothing had been achieved. Israel ran over to stop the war because they can't continue any longer with that.
All right. Many, many thanks, both of you. Professor Saad Nemdra, Professor of Political Science with Birzeit University, as well as Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. I really appreciate it. Have a good day, both. The Palestinian foreign minister slams Israel's aggression and crimes against Palestinians, adding that the regime can no longer enjoy impunity.
Israel is an occupying power, and Israel is not above the law. Israel cannot enjoy impunity. Israel has to be accountable for the crimes that it commits against the Palestinian people on a daily basis. Crimes that tantamount to crimes against humanity and war crimes.
Riyad al-Maliki said the Israeli regime tries to introduce new facts on the ground to turn Jerusalem al-Quds into a Jewish city without any Muslim character. He added that the Israeli policy of settlements expansion and forceful eviction of Palestinians in the city must be stopped. A Palestinian foreign minister stressed that any ceasefire with the regime that does not address these issues does not go far enough. Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the continuation of Washington sanctions as leverage against Tehran in the ongoing nuclear talks is not acceptable. Zarif made the remark during a phone conversation with EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. He said the current U.S. administration should not use sanctions imposed by its predecessor as leverage against Iran. Zarif described the sanctions as, quote, illegal and inhumane, adding that the fundamental change in this approach by the Biden administration is a necessary condition for the success of the Vienna talks. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal have already held several rounds of negotiations in the Austrian capital. They say they made significant progress in the last round, but that key issues remain unresolved. And that's it with international news.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Today. All sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled since Donald Trump took office in the U.S. must be lifted off Iran. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said this early in the year, and it has been repeated time and again by the Foreign Ministry in reference to the ongoing Vienna JCPOA talks. Be it in one step or step by step, The Biden administration must give Iran a full sanctions relief. Only then and after verification will Iran recommit to the nuclear deal, or JCPOA, of 2015. This demand may sound like an unwise ultimatum and the cause for holding talks back. But is it? Flowing talks or hiccups in talks? Vienna has been a scene of trials and efforts in opening up a string of knots that have appeared in the JCPOA talks. Why the knots? How hard is it to see past the obstacles to get the talks going and the JCPOA up and running? I'm Leila Faromayzi. The physical obstacles now are basically, first, Iran's demand when the US does not want to lift all sanctions. It wants to lift nothing more than JCPOA-related sanctions. But what are those? According to Iran, all sanctions are JCPOA-related because immediately after his 2018 pullout from the deal, Trump said he would impose the toughest sanctions ever to get more concessions from Iran in negotiating terms above and beyond the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. We got to talk to Mr. Zangane before he gets inundated with journalists, as MPs tend to do when they leave the chamber.
These stalemates can only be broken when the European Union and the United States start to recognize the Islamic Republic as a free and independent nation with a system of government. Unless they believe that and deem Iran an enemy to their economic, military and political agenda, I'm confident that these hurdles can't be overcome. They need to recognize the dignity, independence and freedom of the Islamic Republic and put aside their hostile attitude towards Iran.
A second obstacle to Vienna talks is the demand made of Iran. The US and other Western parties to the nuclear deal demand that Iran destroy the new generation nuclear centrifuges it installed as a continuation of its remedial measures. Measures to get its JCPOA partners to re-enter or recommit to the deal. Whereas Iran maintains it only has to discontinue the centrifuges by way of the deal. Now there's a little niche, tomato, tomato. Mr. Kumars Yazdanpanah is a geopolitics professor with a practical look in his analyses of current affairs.
Well, closing down enrichment sites isn't that much different from destroying the enrichment machines. If a machine remains unused, it'll start to wear out after a while. This is the difference of the viewpoints, but it's evident that controlling Iran's enrichment level is a crucial and urgent issue for them. It appears that Iran is at a point where it won't be deceived again, and that the haste it made back in 2015, which resulted in the JCPOA not being beneficial to us, won't repeat.
Doesn't look like there's any easy win for Iran. The deal was signed to curb Iran's nuclear program, which this country has maintained is peaceful all along. That was in return for lifting nuclear-related economic UN sanctions off this country. The deal was between Iran and the P5+1, that's the permanent UN Security Council members. The US backed out and left Iran with the UK, France, Russia, China and Germany. The E3 of the collection, that's the three Western European powers, demonstrated no power in the face of US sanctions and were almost as ineffective as the US was destructive to the deal and to the Iranian economy it had promised to boost under the deal.
Iran should build up its capacities by taking other measures, like turning to nations outside the P5+1, especially considering the capacities countries like Japan, South Korea, Australia, India, and even Pakistan have as emerging powers in Asia. These countries, which happen to have good relations with Iran, can be asked to have indirect participation in the process of talks and can be used as leverage to convince the U.S. to put aside its negative attitude toward the JCPOA. This could bring about a brighter future in the negotiations, so the problems can be resolved.
So, on the anniversary of the U.S. pullout, Iran started inching out of its nuclear-related commitments to the JCPOA by, say, enriching uranium up to 20, then 60% purity levels. That's way beyond JCPOA-licensed levels of under 4%. It sure got the West to listen, even get into talks to revive the deal, the Vienna talks. But at what cost for this country? The talks worried Israel and radical elements in the U.S. Natanz, a major nuclear site off the Iranian capital Tehran, was devastated by Israeli sabotage. This was so as to discourage Iran from the talks. Instead, Iran repaired and enhanced Natanz with far more advanced centrifuges.
According to the nuclear deal, Iran has accepted to limit the level of enrichment, uranium enrichment, instead for removing sanctions. So according to the, if the United States is going to have or increase or there are some sanctions by which have been imposed by the Trump administration, so it is the natural right of Iran to increase the level of enrichment. So this is a detail. This, in fact, in negotiations between Iran and the United States, this indirect negotiations, it is very important for both sides to discuss on the details, such details that you refer to. If it is going to have more sanctions, some sanctions on Iran, so it is, this is the natural right of Iran to have more nuclear enrichment. But Iran is ready, as authorities of Iran have claimed many times, Iran is ready to return to the same nuclear deal that was signed in 2015.
Israel's direct or indirect sabotage didn't stop at that. Next, after Palestine's Hamas movement retaliated to Israeli strikes on Palestinians, significantly on Monday, May the 10th, U.S. Republicans stepped up calls on Joe Biden, 13th May, to end talks with Iran. That was in case sanctions relief untied Iran's hands to further support Hamas. Biden disagreed, but in continuing to demand Iran destroy the new generation IR 4, 6, and 9 centrifuges, among others. And that's just for now.
The JCPOA is a new means of colonization. Today, colonizing countries no longer impose their agenda with machine guns, tanks, warplanes and missiles, but with economic, financial and political tools. Take the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank, for example, which aims at colonizing other nations. Their tools are different. They are monetary and financial tools denominated by the dollar. I believe the JCPOA is one of such tools, but presented nicely. It's the same concept the leader of the Islamic Revolution has said before, velvet gloves that cover iron-cast hands.
The U.S. administration wants to return to the JCPOA as a first step. Next, it will be demanding a JCPOA plus or even a JCPOA 2. It's no wonder Iran passed the law earlier on to give them a deadline by threatening to cease cooperation with the IAEA or UN nuclear watchdog. The foreign ministry negotiating team, however, sees hope with the more delicate approach of talks and continued diplomacy. Iranian parliament has pretty much alerted the U.S. to a late May deadline for lifting sanctions off Iran and returning to the JCPOA. Get back in by then, or let's leave the JCPOA alone once and for all, so to speak. But might lawmakers here have softened their tone to give Iranian negotiators in Vienna a better chance at smoothing out the platform for a JCPOA revival? Well, I might have gotten a little carried away with this one, adding too much spice. But we've got a chief announcer and giver of ultimatums to moderate and give us a notion of the parliamentary mood. That would be Mr. Mojtaba Zonnur, head of the Parliamentary National Security and Foreign Policy Committee.
The Strategic Action Plan Act, passed by the Parliament, is, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution said, a good law that needs to be implemented. That's why the Parliament remains steadfast in its position regarding the law. If the May 24 deadline agreed with the IAEA Director General is missed and the Iranian government wants to extend the time, it will be found in breach of the law. The violator will be subject to Article 9 of the law, which has criminalized that and defined punishments to those who object to or obstruct the legislation. The Parliament remains firm on its position regarding the matter.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Seyed Abbas Araghchi, who is leading Iran's negotiating team in Vienna, said the deal may be extended. He did express hope, however, that enough progress will be made so that there will be no need for an extension. But if needed, Iran will consider an extension at a proper time.
We enacted several clauses in the law for lifting sanctions. One clause required the government to immediately begin ramping up Iran's nuclear activities, including installing newer generation centrifuges and reviving the heavy water sectors in Arak, Fordow and Natanz sites. We also defined a time frame for our withdrawal from implementing the additional protocol, meaning to decrease the excess and snap inspections for the IAEA. We started playing the same game that they are.
Given that extending to the deadline might give the wrong signal and lead to misconceptions and miscalculations on the other side, that Iran isn't serious in its positions, the Parliament won't allow an extension. This is so the enemy respects our regulations and understands that once we made a commitment, it can't be changed. If we're not serious about this, the other side would understandably act negligently in performing its duties. That's why we need to stand firm in enforcing the law.
The United States has accepted much of what it ought to do, but there are also some sanctions the U.S. is not willing to lift, said Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh. But Iran has made it clear that these sanctions were imposed to destroy the JCPOA and prevent Iran from reaping benefits from the JCPOA, and thus must be removed.
According to the nuclear deal, sanctions on Iran are categorized by two groups. First, sanctions by the executive orders and sanctions by the Congress acts. According to this deal, the United States government is committed to remove all the sanctions by the executive deal. But for sanctions by the Congress acts, the U.S. government, the President of the United States, is committed to suspend those sanctions. So for Iran, what is important is that to remove the barriers on sanctions, on economic sanctions, which have had essential impacts on the Iranian economy.
It's no secret the U.S. wants to keep some sanctions in place to use them as leverage to expand talks beyond the JCPOA. As leverage in the follow-up talks they wish to initiate with Tehran on JCPOA timelines, as well as Iran's non-nuclear activities. The U.S. has put sanctions into three baskets, green, yellow, and red, depending on how clearly they are inconsistent with the deal. Green will be lifted, yellow is to be negotiated, and red will stay.
A two-level relationship between Iran and the United States that would enable the two sides to directly discuss the matters in person could help clear up some misunderstandings and improve the process of talks, because the negotiations are being held based on distrust, and while such views persist, we can't expect desired results, even on a tactical level.
Plenty more to be said, but let's make a break in our words to see what other media outlets have to say. Stay with me for a quick media review. And here's how it is in the words of others. How desperately does Iran really want sanctions lifted? The Middle East Monitor says why Iran can live without a nuclear deal. Most of the international community, barring Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, welcomes the recent developments regarding the revival of the JCPOA, especially after four turbulent years under the previous Donald Trump administration. But expectations of a revival of the nuclear deal do not necessarily mean that is going to happen, not in a seamless fashion anyway. After weathering the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign, Iran feels both vindicated and defiant. Combined with the country's enhanced leverage in the form of more advanced centrifuges, this state of mind indicates Iran is in no mood to compromise. From an Iranian point of view, while a lasting nuclear deal may be desirable for economic reasons, it is not necessarily indispensable. The Islamic Republic can continue to thrive in the world without the JCPOA. We've got a piece by SP Global. What would it mean to Iran's rival oil producers if sanctions were lifted? Sanctions relief for Iran would pressure rival heavy crude condensate producers. Four rounds of indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran have so far failed to achieve a breakthrough in negotiations to revive the nuclear deal. But rival producers and traders have been eyeing how the competitive landscape may shift if sanctions are lifted on Iranian oil sales. Most experts expect an agreement on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action to be reached within months, if not weeks, which could eventually bring some 2 million barrels per day of Iranian oil back to the market, 2 million barrels. Much of Iran's production is of heavier grades than condensate, and a relaxation of the sanctions will put pressure on the likes of neighboring Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Oman, and even Texas frackers. Refineries worldwide, meanwhile, will likely cheer the extra availability of Iranian crude. The refining hubs of Asia, China, India, South Korea, Japan, and Singapore, have regularly processed Iranian grades, as the high sulfur content and heavy or medium density fit the diet of these complex plants. We've got the Financial Tribune and why it matters to Iran that banking sanctions be lifted. Iranian banking industry wants definite sanctions relief. Iran is pushing for its banking industry to be given guaranteed and conclusive sanctions relief at talks to restore the country's nuclear deal with world powers. The removal of sanctions against the central bank, Iranian bank SWIFT, and any money transfer between them and major foreign correspondent banks needs to be verified. Abdel Nasser Hemmati, the governor of the Central Bank of Iran, told Bloomberg, referring to restrictions on Iranian access to the Belgium-based global payment system. Hemmati said that officials from the central bank are directly involved in the talks to ensure U.S. sanctions removal is tangible. Due to the sanctions imposed by Trump, deals with U.S. companies after the 2015 JCPOA signing that were technically permitted, such as plans to purchase dozens of airliners from Boeing Company, either crept forward or were impossible to complete. Donald Trump, the controversial former U.S. president, piled hundreds more penalties on Iranian lenders, including the central bank, as it ramped up pressure on Tehran. That would be it for this segment, but do stay tuned. Iran rejects any categorization of sanctions to partially lift them. Be they Obama-era sanctions or Trump-fancy sanctions, be they recognized as JCPOA-related or unrelated. Although Iran maintains they are all JCPOA-related and the U.S. seems to agree deep down.
Iran is insistent on some of its internal policies. They are also insisting that Iran abandons and readjusts those policies. It doesn't appear that the two would mix well or the JCPOA would be able to work to Iran's benefits, albeit in a minimal way. Iran wants all sanctions removed, but many sanctions aren't JCPOA related. Even if 50% of the JCPOA related sanctions are suspended and not lifted, it would be a positive development for Iran.
Anyhow, it was the U.S. that pulled out of the deal, disregarding UNSC Resolution 2231, which the JCPOA rests on. In other words, it was the U.S. that caused the standoff with a mess of sanctions imposed later to sabotage the JCPOA. That was in the Trump era, but even Joe Biden for months refused to lift any sanctions before Iran takes the first step to recommitting. U.S. pressures have only been backfiring. Here's a point. Practice of the law can only be so different from what the law says. and the way the U.S. and allies have boldly gone about the deal as though it were never meant to lift sanctions to begin with makes you wonder just that. Was the JCPOA never meant to lift sanctions off this country, only to temporarily suspend them?
First is not the removal of all sanctions. We had this ambiguity with our colleagues in the foreign ministry. They said according to the JCPOA, all sanctions would be lifted without any preconditions on the date the deal was signed. But we said it won't happen for two reasons. One is the nature of the imperialist system that won't allow it, and the second is the text that was being signed. The JCPOA text has tied the lifting of sanctions to tens of preconditions. If you consider how the sanctions are planned to be removed in the JCPOA, which doesn't include all anti-Iran sanctions, you'll notice that practically nothing will happen.
Earlier on in the talks, Abbas Araghchi said Iran requires no roadmap to restore the deal. In our view, there is no step-by-step plan. We only have a final step that the U.S. needs to take to lift the sanctions it has imposed, reimposed, or relabeled during the past 4 years. We will verify, and then Iran will return to its commitments. That's not all. Iran wants guarantees from the U.S. and its Western European partners that sanctions won't be reimposed on this country as soon as the deal gets going. Because then the U.S. as a member will have the power to trigger the snapback mechanism. That way, all sanctions can come flooding Iran all in one go. However, Joe Biden seems too level-headed to act outside strategy to unnecessarily cause a breach of trust. Now, are all sanctions really vital to lift? So what if high-up individuals remain on the U.S. list of persons of interest to sacrifice themselves for the country to see oil and banking and other sanctions lifted to see its economy flourish?
Some of these sanctions are imposed on people who are active in large companies, which constitute non-governmental relations between Iran and other nations in trade, commerce, export of goods, and import and export of raw materials, and so on. Sanctioning these people has put additional pressure on Iran. These aren't serious sanctions and don't have that much legal burden on either side. If these sanctions are lifted, talks on other aspects of the JCPOA can be facilitated, which in turn can gain the trust of Tehran. So the Iranian parliament would accept to extend the deadlines it has set so the government can have the time for talks.
There is a thing called Congress in the U.S., but might there be any legal loopholes for individual U.S. states to separately impose sanctions on Iran if the U.S. returns to the deal?
Such a thing doesn't exist in the legal structure of the U.S. It's also incompatible with international law. It's not like any state can arbitrarily do whatever it wants. It's up to the Security Council and the President of the United States.
There is no structure already for imposing sanctions on states, and there is very few precedents for such sanctions in U.S. history. So the second is that companies and countries do not take sanctions by separate states as serious as they take the sanctions by the federal government of the United States.
So how have details on the ground been looking in Vienna further on since a week after a fourth round of talks had begun on Friday, the 7th of May? In dismissing Republican calls to cease nuclear talks, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made a good point on the same day, May the 13th. It was the straightforward answer, the sort of common sense comment Iran has been making all along to fall on deaf ears. He said, "I don't have anything to offer on whether or not there is Iranian involvement in what is taking place in Gaza. But when it comes to any of the malign activities that Iran may or may not engage in, that only underscores the importance that we do everything we can to ensure that Iran never acquires a nuclear weapon." In other words, you want to curb Iran's power? Allow talks to go on in Vienna to see if we can return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. But do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. Nuclear talks are ongoing, and we are getting close to election day in Iran. Till next time, bye.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhis salam. Please stay with me. Imam Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "On the Day of Judgment, a caller will call, 'Where are as-sabirun, the patient?' So a group of people will arise. Then a caller will call, 'Where are al-mutasabirun?' Thus a group of people will rise." Imam Baqir was asked, "Who are as-sabirun and al-mutasabirun?" Imam Baqir, peace be upon him, replied, "As-sabirun are those who are patient with performing the religious duties. Al-mutasabirun are those who are patient with the prohibitions."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the beautiful conversations and dialogues from the Holy Prophet and the divinely appointed Imams, we find that the fifth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, had a great opportunity to be able to have these conversations and these discussions with his companions, with his friends, and with the people in general. We find in these conversations and in these dialogues that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam speaks about a whole range of issues and subject matters, whether it is philosophy or theology, whether it is the history of the Muslims or the Holy Quran, or whether it is ethical and moral standards which the Muslims and even humanity in general must follow. In one such conversation and in one such dialogue, we find that Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace and blessings upon him, has talked about the ethical qualities and the rules of social conduct as far as Islam is concerned. So when his companions asked him about certain specific social and Islamic etiquettes, Imam al-Baqir talked about certain negative and bad qualities as well as some evil deeds which the Muslims must refrain from, and matter of fact, which human beings in general must refrain from. So when asked about certain bad qualities of the tongue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies that evil deeds as far as the tongue is concerned includes backbiting the friend, telling lies, and slander. Tuhmat. Allahu Akbar. This tongue seems to be such an insignificant thing, this small piece of a muscle, endowed with such power, given to it, of course, by Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. But just like every thing that Allah has given us, every power, every faculty which Allah has given us human beings, it can be used either for good or it can be used for evil. It is up to us, the choice, dear friends. We can use this tongue to promote the message of truth and justice, nobility and honor. Or we can use this very tongue towards evil ends. And so here, as far as evil ends is concerned, Imam al-Baqir tells us that backbiting our friends is an evil deed. Telling lies, of course, is an evil deed. To the extent where, in some places, it is said that the key to all evils is to lie. And finally, is tuhmat, slander. When we slander somebody else, when we say something about somebody else which isn't true, slander. Three very important things which we must refrain from brought to us in this dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
There's a nice essay by Toshiko Murata in the book called Islamic Spirituality. She's Japanese. She studied in Tehran, and apparently she also attended some of the lectures or might have seen Allama Tabatabai as well, right? In geology, an article on that, right? We read about angels in the du'as. Have we really questioned, asked? It really requires that. Now this place is not where we can talk everything now. 9:30 happens, loads of emails, Maulana went 3 minutes over, 4 minutes over, right? No, it's, and I respect that. No. And it has to be there. Tomorrow is a weekday. You know, people have to go to work, right? So everything needs to be, but it requires, okay, now we could say that, okay, we are having classes upon the sciences of the names of the Lord. We have that available for you. Then we have to really participate in it. Not that the classes is there, five people come and attend, you know. The opportunity is given, nobody attends. then we are not really true followers of Baqirain and Sadiqain.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.